You're listening to the Stone Tapes on Siren 107.3 FM with Sam Stone and friends.
And there's a very bad moon arising here in Lincolnshire today. And we're on the Stone Tapes. I'm Sam Stone. And with me in the studio this week is Patricia H. Ash.
Hello.
David J. Howe.
Watch her.
On the telephone, I believe Robin, our correspondent in Wales, is there. Hi, Robin.
Greetings.
Hi. And you know who we've got in the studio today, Robin? It's a really nice surprise, this.
I think it might be my favourite Bajoran Dabo girl.
Well, thank you so much. It's Chase Masterson.
Hi, everybody.
From Los Angeles.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
Hi, Robin. Hi, everybody. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
We're so glad to have you here today.
My pleasure.
So, this month, being Halloween month, we thought we would have a chat about werewolves.
Oh my.
What was your favourite werewolf story or novel or book? Ooh. Novel or book, that's the same thing. Or movie.
Well done, Sam. Well, I think Robin, you were going to take us way back to where all this perhaps started from a filmic perspective, yeah?
That is correct, sir, yes.
So over to you, sir.
Well, what we know of werewolves, what we see in werewolves these days, was not always the case. The first werewolf film made was called Werewolf of London, made by Universal Pictures in 1935. And this is way before they started messing around with silver bullets and gypsy curses and all the rest of it. This concerns an eccentric botanist called Wilfred Glendon, played by Henry Hull. And he's on a self-financed expedition, because he's really rich, to Tibet to go and get the Marifaza plant. Now, the Marifaza is a really rare and also fictitious plant, which only blooms during a certain time of year, during a full moon. Mm-hmm. But as he finds this rare plant, and interestingly enough, for the purposes of this film, Tibet is actually Vasquez Rocks, immortalized by so many classic Star Trek episodes.
is that where Kirk fought the Gorn and all that kind of stuff?
That is exactly the place, yes.
Iconic.
Iconic.
So, you know, we are bringing together Star Trek and werewolves.
Well
right?
Done,
trying my best here.
And you can rely on you.
That's beautiful,
Ron. Anyway, he's attacked by a mysterious beast, gets his flower, comes back to London, starts to turn all furry at the full moon. An Oriental called Dr. Yogami claims to have met him in Tibet while also seeking the Marathaser. And it turns out that Yogami is actually the werewolf who attacked him. Now, the Marathaser will bloom 3 times, and it's the juice extracted from the petals of the Marathaser that is a temporary antidote for werewolfism. Now, the werewolf always goes after whatever he loves the most, and in this case, he tries to kill his wife, which may be reassuring for her. We don't know, but she runs away from him anyway, leaving him to be shot dead by Scotland Yard. After first killing Yogami, of course. So that was it for werewolf movies.
So Robin, did they invent that for that film, do you know?
Lycanthropy is actually
I didn't mean,
and recognised medical condition.
No, I didn't mean lycanthropy. I meant the
Marathaser.
Well, obviously, it's the Marathaser, yes. Fictitious, the cure for werewolves.
Yep.
This was all invented for that film, basically.
This was all invented. It was all written by a guy called Robert Harris. Robert Harris wrote the original story, and a guy called John Colton adapted it into a screenplay. Because Universal were after another monster. They had the Frankenstein monster, they had Dracula, they had the Invisible Man, and they had the Mummy. But the Werewolf of London didn't take off that well. There were a lot of problems with the filming because the actor Henry Hull didn't like the makeup that Jack P. Pierce, Universal's makeup man, no relation, unfortunately, had devised, and he lobbied very hard, because he was a theatrical actor, to have his face more recognisable.
Nice.
So it didn't make very much money, and it wasn't until 1941, and screenwriter Kerl Stjordmark, that we actually had Gypsy Curses, Silver Bullets, and the old rhyme, which many people believe to be traditional but really isn't, of even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright.
That's right.
Yes, fantastic.
That was all made up by Kurt Sjordmark.
Now, am I right in thinking, Robin, that the Werewolf of London film no longer exists?
No, it does exist.
It does exist, does it?
I do believe that the one that you're citing is London After Midnight.
Ah, that's the Chaney one, the Lon Chaney.
Yes, film. 1925,
yes.
Lon Chaney,
yes.
Which was remade in 1935 with Bela Lugosi as the fake vampire hunting down a murderer.
Yes. Right.
So this original Werewolf of London, that does exist. Oh, we have to see that.
It still does exist, and it is actually on my shelf.
Is it really?
Wow. Well,
you'll have to send it down to
us. I watched it earlier on today.
We'll have to come and visit.
So you've got the only copy. Oh, my word.
Now we know where to go. Do you know what struck me when you were explaining about the werewolf going after the people it most loved? I can see Del Toro's influences, perhaps, from this film in The Strain, because his vampires do the very same thing. The minute they turn, they go after
they
the people. So it, it just shows you how well versed in the mythos, you might say, that Del Toro is.
It's interesting you mention that as well, though, because isn't Benicio Del Toro's film, The Werewolf.
Isn't
that the most recent werewolf
That is
film?
The most recent most werewolf recent film, and it's a very loose remake of the 1941 Wolfman with Lon Chaney.
Right, that's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
I do like it. You watched that recently.
We watched that one recently,
I did watch that one recently. I do like it. Have you seen that one?
I've seen the original Wolfman with Lon Chaney, but
Chaney.
I haven't seen this new one. I was hesitant to see it because it was
kind of a remake,
and I really liked the original, so...
It's pretty good, isn't it? It's pretty good.
It's not bad at all.
Anyway, so what's your favourite werewolf movie of all time, Robin?
My favourite werewolf movie of all time...
If you have one.
I do. I do, and it ties in nicely because it's The Howling.
Ah. Yeah. Well, we're going to be talking about that very shortly.
It's very interesting because
we
you
sure
asked
are.
That. You asked that, Simon.
I hope you're going to stay with us for that.
And my
I do, and I've got some trivia for you for later on.
And my answer...
And that was Fresh Blood by the Eels. And we're off now to Patricia's Corner to see what she's been reading this week.
Well, this week I have been reading Bitten by Kelly Armstrong. Yay. It's about werewolves.
Oh!
No one is surprised. Okay, so what it's about is it's about this woman named Elena, and she's the only female werewolf in the entire world. Not really sure how that works. There's an explanation in the book.
Okay.
But there it is. And what she's trying to do is be a normal human. Just live a normal human life with a normal human boyfriend and just, you know, sneak off and change every so often into a werewolf.
Does he know?
He has no idea. Oh. He thinks she's a completely ordinary person who likes to take walks in the middle of the night for
some
reason.
So we've got a whole double life thing going
on
there.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's doing pretty well at this impersonating a human normal person thing until the pack calls. And the pack is the closest thing Elena has ever had to a family. There's a lot of complicated emotional issues because the pack also includes the guy who bit her and turned her into a werewolf. So that's complicated. But so she has to go home, I guess, to where the pack lives and help them deal with an emergency. And, well, things happen. The messy emotional things with the guy who turned her into a werewolf. This is a romance, essentially, with dressed in fur.
Right, a romance dressed in fur. I like that. That's a good quote. Talk about loving a guy who's bad for you.
I mean, exactly.
Meta.
I mean, he didn't really bite her. It was more like a nip, just a little one. But it turned her into a werewolf anyway. And
rude.
I know.
I mean, he could have at least taken her out on a date first.
Oh, he did.
Oh
he did. He did take her out on several dates first, and then nipped her. But then she turned into a werewolf, and she really wishes he'd said something about that beforehand. So, messy emotional issues.
I can see where she's coming from.
Exactly.
I think I've seen those billboards. If you're a werewolf, talk about it. I mean, right? There should be.
I think so.
There should be.
Don't be afraid to ask.
Don't worry, I'm going to go furry once a month.
Well, they go furry more often than that.
That's a good point, though, actually. So that the whole bitten thing, with she's bitten, she turns into a werewolf. Mm-hmm. You said it's more frequent than that, so it's not every full moon. What I was going to say was, so it's not kind of... I'm thinking of the film Ginger Snaps, which is a great horror film, which very much draws an analogy between a woman's cycle and turning into a wolf once a month.
It's a very good film.
This isn't doing that, then. This isn't trying to draw any kind of parallels.
No, it's just for narrative convenience that they can change whenever they want. Right. So they can be a person and then a wolf running through the forest. And then several wolves.
So they have control over it, then, to a certain degree.
To a certain degree. Sometimes if they get particularly frightened, it happens, and they didn't, you know, mean for it to happen, but it does, which is just fairly common in werewolf lore when the werewolf can control the change. They're like, oh, no, I'm upset, and I'm furry. Oh, darn. Whoops.
Whoopsie. I killed you. Oh, dear.
You didn't need those intestines, right? Oh, no. So
how did you find the book overall, then? What's the verdict?
It's well written. It's an engaging story. But the having her be the only female werewolf in the entire world kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah.
It's like when you're petting a dog and you pet the fur the wrong way and then they snap at you. It was a bit like that.
So the pack is all male, then?
Yeah, they're all male, except for Elena.
So that doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
So the guys have been kissing and biting each other, is the bottom line.
that makes sense.
If they that's, you know.
Well, maybe he was the only straight.
It wasn't that kind of book, but I kind of wish it was.
Oh, my.
There's a lot of implications here.
Yes.
Apparently in this book, the werewolf gene is passed down. It's on the Y chromosome. It's passed down from father to son. And the only way a woman could be, well, this is not exactly true because genetics is not exactly that neat, but the only way a woman could be turned is if she gets a bitten, which is the title of the book by Kelly Armstrong.
I see.
So what would you give this one as a mark?
6.5 out of 10.
Right.
If you like the Anita Blake novels by Laurel K. Hamilton, you're going to love this one.
Well, I think Anita Blake probably sound like they were a lot better, to be honest. I read a lot of those. They went off for me at about book 6.
Yeah.
When it just became a bit more about eroticism rather than actual story.
Porn with a little bit of plot instead of plot with a little bit of porn. I like my plot with a little
bit of
porn.
Or decent incentives to keep me at it. I'm starting to feel just a little bit. teacher and her student to look at the single man. I got on me a special radar on the fire department hotline in case I get in trouble later. Not looking for cute little devils or rich city guys. I just want to enjoy having a very good time and behave very bad in the arms of a boy. Is all she wants in the closet.
The Midweek Drive on Siren FM 107.3.
Are you there? Are you there? Are you there?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
This is who we are.
Coffee House Hermits from Lincoln, England. We're all travellers in space and time.
With strange characters.
And it's the one with the nose.
I absolutely love her.
And surprises galore.
A free concert. Think of it as being sung to by Elvis Presley.
Unusual discussion topics.
Why would you want to give every child a water pistol? It was a bit like choosing between kittens and babies.
That will make your ribs soul.
You have really done your homework. Aw, thank you.
That's what we call show business.
Join the Midweek Drive team every Wednesday from 5 till 7 on Siren FM 107.3.
And back to Robin. Robin, what's your favourite? I know you were saying before you love The Howling. Have you read any novels, werewolfy novels, or any Kelly Armstrong?
I haven't read any Kelly Armstrong. I've read Gary Brandner's Howling back in the 80s because I was so taken with the film. And again, I think it was the early 80s, a number of books were released in paperback, novelizations of the old Universal films that I love so much.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was of the Wolfman, and it kind of took the stance that it was all in Larry Talbot, the Lon Chaney character's head, that he didn't really turn into an animal. It was like an inner beast, and it was how he saw himself, which I thought was very clever.
Interesting. Talking of inner beasts.
Inner beasts.
I believe it's the 50th anniversary of the Cybermen.
Indeed.
At the moment.
Indeed.
And
I think we're going to have a little... Here they come. Yes, 50th anniversary. And I don't think we'd find a cyber werewolf, would we? We wouldn't find a Cyberman turning into a werewolf.
Well, that'd be a really interesting upgrade.
It would be a very interesting upgrade. Anyway, 1966, Doctor Who, the very last William Hartnell story called The Tenth Planet was when the Cybermen first appeared. So we thought we'd have some cyber memories and stuff like that around here. So I think, Robin, you probably watched a couple of cyber stories, haven't you?
Actually, you are not going to believe this. I was watching The Tenth Planet on DVD over the weekend
with my wife.
And it had the animated last episode.
Yes.
And I wanted to check it out particularly because I'm looking forward so much to seeing Power of the Daleks again.
Absolutely, when they release that. And in fact, I think, just looking forward to the next edition of the Stone Tapes, it's going to be a Dalek special. But enough of that. So the Cybermen appeared quite extensively in the 60s. Obviously, as I said, they started with William Hartnell. And then Patrick Troughton's Doctor, he met them four times, I think. Moonbase and Tomb of the Cybermen, William Space, Invasion. Fantastic creations. I always actually preferred them to the Daleks myself.
Anything to the Daleks. You prefer
I say, Patricia, have you seen? What have you seen of the 60s Cybermen?
not much of the 60s Cybermen, but they do always seem a little bit more threatening than the Daleks, because they can climb stairs.
They can, yes.
Although
yes.
that's been yeah. rectified.
That
in
has
modern.
Been rectified.
It has, now has they can rectified. Fly. But
there's a tremendous kind of
Cybermen can fly too.
There's a tremendous kind of spookiness about them. And I know, Chase, you kind of saw some stuff with the Cybermen in.
Two
of
the Cybermen.
So, what
yeah. Well, clearly the Borg were this generation's representation of the Cybermen. Yeah. I mean, becoming one with them and being assimilated. It's pretty clear where that. Although, you know, it could be a general science fiction concept that. I don't know. Could it have come from anywhere else? No, it was definitely.
No, I think it's
a direct ripoff.
Got I think it was a direct ripoff.
All right, there
but
you go.
Don't worry about it because Doctor Who rips off lots of things all the time as
it
well.
Everybody rips off everything. That's the thing. Yeah. Everything is ripped off from somewhere. Generally,
I mean the concept of someone turning into something else and this big scary hive mind taking over people and machines and stuff. That's always been pretty scary and will probably continue to be pretty scary. Yeah, kind of like being buried alive is pretty scary.
But I think unlike kind of the Wolfman, where the person kind of, or I suppose Dr. Jekyll as well to some extent, the person kind of turns themselves into this beast thing. With the Cybermen, it's like you are turned. It's like you don't really have any choice in this, you know, in the Borg too.
In
it's like they come and get you and they put all their implants in and they rip away all your humanity and turn you into these kind of emotionless things that then go and do the same stuff to other people. It's quite terrifying, this kind of body horror that's going on there.
And yet, like all good science fiction, it's a representation of what happens in real life. I mean, when a society takes over another society, this is probably totally the wrong thing to say, but such as colonialism, you know, you go into somewhere, you take over them, and then they become like you and do your bidding and become one with you
if they know what's good for them.
if they want to live, you know, that's the basic, that's the bottom line, or else they die. And
it's all based on our horror of the loss of individuality, though, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I'll just say right now, because I use the word colonialism, the U.S. has done that, you know, consistently. We still do.
Yeah.
And, you know, very unfortunately.
Well, we've done some of that ourselves, you know.
Well, yeah. Yes. And so we just, that's the type of thing that we need to really use science fiction as a metaphor for real life and realize that we need to respect other cultures, as in the Prime Directive, and we need to not make anyone ever suffer that loss of individuality. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, one of the important lessons. We don't want it done to us, so why would we do it in other cultures?
Yes,
but
it's true.
But I digress.
so absolutely, Doctor Who's kind of always played with that, though. That loss of individuality has been at the heart of some of the most scary episodes, and the Cybermen are a great example of that. And indeed, even, you know, we bring it right up to date, and the Cybermen are still appearing in the show. And, you know, we had them.
They're still one of the most horrifying monsters
in
the show.
One of the most horrifying and terrifying and powerful things that the show's kind of developed. So it's like 50 years of Cybermen stomping across our screens. It's absolutely fantastic.
Quite incredible.
Yeah. kind of gent who ran amok in Kent. Lately he's been overheard in Mayfair. You better stay away from him. He'll rip your lungs out, Jim. I'd like to meet his tailor. Ow, werewolves of London. Saw Lon Chaney walking with the Queen, doing the werewolves of London. I saw Lon Chaney Jr. walking with the Queen, doing the werewolves of London. I saw a werewolf drinking a pina colada at Trader Vic's. His hair was perfect.
And now, we're back with the adorable Chase Masterson.
Aw. Thank you, Sam. You're pretty adorable yourself.
Thank you. Yay. Chase is a lovely friend, and yes, I'm very, very happy that she's here today.
I'm very happy to see you, my friend.
Oh, thank you. And, of course, I'm going to open it up to the guys here to see if they've got any questions, because I can ask you any time at all. Lots of questions about Star Trek and
life in general.
And life in general, even more important, actually.
Yes, much more important.
But since we've been talking about the Cybermen and the link to Star Trek and, of course, the loss of identity and self, I think it's a perfect time now to say to everybody, what question would you like to ask Chase Masterson? Robin, can I go over to you first?
Oh, going to the Trekkie first. Classy
yes.
move.
Good. Say.
Chase.
Hi, Robin.
Hi.
How are you?
Very, very well, thank you. Honoured to be talking to you again.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you.
How do you feel Star Trek has affected your career as an actress? Do you think it's limited the roles you've been able to go for after that? Or do you feel that it has highlighted you as an actress and you're able to pursue other things like your anti-bullying campaign?
I think that Star Trek DS9, I know that it was not watched by the general industry in the way that Next Gen was, and possibly that Voyager and Enterprise were. I think, therefore, the general industry doesn't really know if you say she was on Deep Space Nine, even right after it ended, it was like, oh, yeah, that's like sci-fi, right? And because we were not watched as much by the industry and early on in the real be a geek craze, I think it didn't help in terms of general career. I did a lot of other work at a certain time. While I was doing DS9, I was on a lot of other shows coinciding. There were sometimes I was even on opposite myself, like on two different channels at the same time. But after that, I went through a very hard time personally, and with DS9 not being as widely watched by the industry as we would have liked it to be, there's a lot to be said about momentum, and I think that I know that I lost some momentum. There's ups and downs to that. In terms of career, it wasn't great. In terms of real life, it was absolutely great. And I started realizing how much I want to make a difference in the world out of that, and started doing a lot of nonprofit work, mentoring kids at Homeboy Industries, raising a lot of different money for charity, and still doing a lot of conventions and keeping up a profile within the science fiction world. So it's a double-edged sword, really. It really is. And I can't lay responsibility on DS9 or on the industry, or on my own tough real life issues at that time. All I can do is just realize that life takes you in different directions, and I'm really grateful for having so many good things in mind.
Patricia?
Well, I love Star Trek and everything, but I'm really curious about your anti-bullying campaign, actually.
Thank you.
How'd that get started? Where is it now?
Thank you so much for asking. As I said, I was doing a lot of nonprofit work, and in 2008, I started mentoring kids coming out of gangs at a place called Homeboy Industries, and I taught a life planning class, and it's a long story of how I started doing that, but a friend of mine was marketing a self-help book, and he asked me for some help and some ideas, and I said, well, if you want to know if your self-help book works, why don't you take it to people who really need it? Don't take it to the Downtown Women's Club or Merrill Lynch or whatever. Take it to people who can use it and see if it works. So I walked into Homeboy Industries with him in October of 2007, and we absolutely fell in love with those kids. They're, I call them kids, but a lot of them have done 10 and 20 years in prison, and they always come straight out of prison to Homeboy, and well, the ones that are at Homeboy come straight out of prison, and Homeboy helps them get their lives together, get jobs, job training, high school diplomas. They do classes in different types of things. They have a cafe and a bakery there. They do solar paneling classes, guitar classes, computer classes, etc. So I taught a life planning class, and the best way to I ever heard that described was this girl came straight into the lobby one day, and she was really, really new and hard and cold from 10 years in prison. And she said, this does apply. She goes, what's your class like? And the guy with tattoos all over his face broke into the conversation. He overheard, and he came over and he said, what's your class like? I'll tell you. Did you ever see a picture on your parents' refrigerator, or maybe like, you know, when they had one just out that was like them holding you as a baby and the blanket, and you're right there with your mom, and you knew if you, you know, if you could have frozen that moment that everything would be okay? That's what her class is like.
Oh,
I know, right?
Oh,
I know.
Wow,
right? So I love those kids and work with them very closely. Would give them each my phone number and say, would you, you know, you can call me anytime. I'm here to help you. And I help them, you know, get their driver's licenses, and I help them get jobs and to college, and substance abuse counseling many times, and domestic violence abuse help and all sorts of stuff. And I asked one of them, who was the head of the Crips, both outside and inside Folsom, what got you started in this horrible life, this painful life you had? And he told me that he and his friends were bullied on the playground when they were like 10 years old. And so they formed a little gang in order to protect themselves from the bullies. Mm-hmm. And the bullies grew, and they grew, and they grew, and they grew, and their tactics got worse, and they eventually got absorbed into the Crips.
Yeah.
And so I started thinking, and I started asking a lot of the kids, and that was the same story. It was nobody wanted that kind of life. People become bullies, and they become aggressive out of fear. And I started thinking a lot about the fact that oppression is the same dynamic, whether you're in kindergarten, first grade, high school, workplace bullying, gender bullying, relationship bullying, or war. It's oppression that has no place in a relationship or in society. So how much time do I have? One more minute?
You're good.
This is my favorite thing to talk about. So then at the very same time, this little girl named Katie was bullied for liking Star Wars in the first grade, and I read about it. I didn't know Katie, but I read about it, and her mom, she told her mom, Mom, I'm not going to like Star Wars anymore because I'm getting bullied at school. And her mom was like, wait a second, that's not okay for you to get gender bullied. Girls can like anything they want. You can mm-hmm. do anything you want in this world, Katie.
Too true.
So her mom wrote a blog about this, and it went, they went to sleep, and Huffington Post picked up the blog overnight. Yes, and thousands of people saw the blog post. It went viral, and hundreds of us posted, Katie, we love science fiction. We love Star Wars. You can be whoever you want to be. You be yeah. you. And Katie and her mom woke up to hundreds of messages encouraging Katie, and a message from Lucasfilm.
Oh, amazing.
And Carrie's mother decided that she wanted to write a book about this experience because gender bullying just has no place in the world. So she interviewed me, and she asked for other people to interview, and she... I put her in touch with Peter Mayhew, who played Chewbacca. So now little Katie, who got bullied in first grade, is friends with the real Chewbacca. Don't screw with us. And so, not to make the story longer, but I'll just tell you real quickly, Carrie finished the book. HarperCollins bought it, and Carrie asked me to help her get her book into Comic-Con. And I said, yes, I'll do that, but let's do more than that. Let's get the power of science fiction and of this whole genre, science fiction, fantasy, horror. Let's get all of these people that love Comic-Con so much, and let's put them to work for heroism in real life. We love these shows where we see the good guys win. Let's be the good guys. So I formed the Pop Culture Hero Coalition, and that's our web address, popcultureherocoalition.org. We work in Comic-Con, schools, and communities. We're the first ever program to make a stand against bullying, racism, misogyny, cyberbullying, LGBT bullying, and other forms of hate using pop culture.
Fantastic. And awesome. More after this. A little bit of Green Day and Boulevard of Broken Dreams.
I walk a lonely road, the only one that I have ever known. Don't know where it goes, but it's only me and I walk alone. I walk this empty street on the boulevard of broken dreams, where the city sleeps and I'm the only one, and I walk alone. I walk alone, I walk alone. I walk alone, I walk up. My shadow's only one that walks beside me. My shallow heart's the only thing that's beating. Sometimes I wish someone out there will find me. Till then I walk alone. This empty street on the boulevard of broken dreams, where the city sleeps and I'm the only one, and I walk up. My shadow's the only one that walks beside me. My shallow heart's the only thing that's beating. Sometimes I wish someone out there will find me.
Now it's time. It is that time. Yes, it is. It is that time indeed, where we go over to David for his film of the month. And this might be a little bit of a clue as to what that film is.
A kind of strange. My hands are feeling a bit itchy, and the hairs starting to come out on them. So I think we've not got long left, guys.
It's funny you say that. I seem to have a little bit of...
My teeth are awfully sharp.
Yeah, it's weird, though, isn't it? Are you okay, Robin? Are you feeling the change?
I am indeed feeling the change. Yeah, I think I might need a shave.
There's something in the air. So our film of the month this month is The Howling. And the background music we have here, of course, the music from The Howling by the awesome Pino Donaggio. Now, The Howling, it's a 1981 horror film, directed by Joe Dante and starring Dee Wallace, Patrick McNee, him off the Avengers, Dennis Dugan and Robert Picardo, who is one of Chase's pals. It's a bit scary, isn't it? Yes. It's based on the novel of the same name by Gary Brandner. And I think I actually read the novel first, and then I saw the film. And I loved the novel. I thought Gary did a fantastic job with that. And in fact, if you can track down any of Gary Brandner's books, they're all pretty awesome. So the film, pretty straightforward, really. Dee Wallace plays a television film news reporter who goes undercover to try and trap this killer called Robert Quist. Is it Robert Quist? I think it's Robert Quist. Eddie Quist, called Eddie Quist, who's been killing people, and she tracks him down, and there's a lovely, lovely scene set in, strangely, a sort of a sex video bar thing, which is very, very evocative, and he kind of is behind her, and it's a wonderful film. She gets kind of traumatised from that. He nipped her. We talked about nipping her earlier. He nipped her. I think he nipped her then, yeah. And
I think it wasn't clear.
Not clear. But basically, because she's so traumatised, she gets sent to this the colony, it's called, of people living in the kind of like on a lake, I suppose, or something. It's sort of having a great time. There's a cabin, and they do barbecues and all sorts of stuff. But of course, what she doesn't quite realise is that all the people in the colony are, in fact, werewolves.
It might as well be called The Pack.
The Pack. Yes. It could be, should be called The Pack.
These are the creepiest townspeople ever.
So for me, what makes this film, and it's very interesting that there were three films released in 1981. There was The Howling, An American Werewolf in London, and Wolfen.
Yes,
and everyone talks about American Werewolf in London and the most amazing transformation that Rick Baker did in that film. I think The Howling actually tops it for a werewolf transformation. It's done by Rob Bottin, who was one of Rick Baker's prodigies. The difference is that in American Werewolf in London, the transformation happens in broad daylight, in the middle of a lounge. Mm-hmm. It's all bright lights. Nothing is hidden.
Yes.
In The Howling, it's all done in a creepy, shadow-filled, nighttime kind of medical office.
It's much creepier in The Howling.
Very, very creepy.
And I mean, it might be more technically impressive in American Werewolf in London,
but The Howling, it's creepy in The Howling. I think tops it. It's an incredible transformation. It's a lovely film. If you've not seen it, it's well worth trying to dig out The Howling.
It's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube, is it? Thank you. So, Robin, you saw The Howling?
I saw The Howling back in 1981 when it came out. It's my favourite werewolf movie because I've always considered it to be above and beyond An American Werewolf in London, the werewolf movie of choice for werewolf movie fans because there are so many in-jokes in it.
Yes.
Yes, true.
And references. I mean, Patrick McNee's character, George Wagner, is named for the director of The Wolfman. William Neal, Christopher Soane's character, is named for the director of Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman.
And I can see here we've got Fred Francis as another character, the director.
Terry Fisher. The werewolf,
I'm just looking now. Yes.
And John Carradine's character, Earl Kenton, Earl C. Kenton, the last two in the werewolf cycle by Universal, he directed them.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
That's
fantastic. And I also love the appearance of Forrest Ackerman in Dick.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, you've got to have Dick Miller. Dick Miller is the shop owner. And Forrest Ackerman wandering around the shop with copies of Famous Monsters in his hands.
Copies of Famous Monsters, exactly.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. And of course, I've got to give mention to Robert Picardo, who turns in the most amazing performance as Eddie Quist. Now, I know you've worked with Robert, haven't you? You know Robert very well. So what did you make of that?
I do know Robert, and I have to say, I haven't seen the film, but nothing in the film could possibly be as scary as the fact that Robert is wearing hair. That just terrifies me. I mean, really.
He looks so different, doesn't
he? So different.
He does. He looks incredibly different. And we saw some photos of the gunshot and the...
It's completely ironic, though, because Robert's practically made a new career out of being his bald self.
So he's tremendous as Eddie Quist. He's so evil. And it's such a great performance in the film.
I couldn't believe it was him, actually.
Yeah.
It was so different from the Robert Picardo we know now.
Mm. Absolutely, absolutely.
A great performance.
I'm just having a quick look now in my notes here just to see what we've got. Anything else? I mean, obviously, there's quite a lot of differences from the novel. I mean, one of the main elements is, I think the novel, if you remember the novel, Robin, takes it all quite seriously, whereas the film has a little bit of a kind of a comic edge to it.
It's slightly
tongue-in-cheek.
It's tongue-in-cheek. So I just love the film. I think, as you say, I think for me it's head and shoulders above most other werewolf films. I mean, a lot of the werewolf films actually are very good. We were doing a little poll online, weren't we, to sort of see what werewolf films people knew. Mm. And it was interesting, the same kind of half a dozen films came up over and over and over again.
The ones mostly that we've spoken about, like Ginger Snaps.
Absolutely. American Werewolf, of course, The Howling.
Yep.
People have got a soft spot for some of the others, like the old Ollie Reed one, The Curse of the Werewolf.
Yeah, I love that one.
That's a great fun film. It's a tremendous film. I think for me, it's one of these solid 9 out of 10s for me. I love that film. What did you make of it, Patricia? What would you give it?
I gave it 8 out of 10.
8, yeah. Sam?
What about you, Rob? I was going to say,
Robin, go first.
Come on.
I'll give it a solid 9.5 because where else can you see Dee Wallace Stone turn into a were Pekingese at the end of
the film?
That is hilarious.
And that is the weak point,
that
I think,
is
of the film, to
is the one
fair.
Weak point.
It was the weak point.
Cutest little werewolf I ever did see, unless Chase Masterson turned into a werewolf.
She reminded me of Lancelot, or Sir Didymus, actually.
Sir Didymus. Oh, I'm definitely getting very hairy here. My hands are going. Oh, dearie. Sam, your face, it's all... You've got a very cute little nose on you there that's twitching, a little blackly.
Looking
there.
A bit Sir Didymus now.
Sir Didymus now.
Thanks so much to David J. Howe, Patricia H. Hash, Robin Pierce, our very special guest, Chase Masterson. Masterton, I keep calling him Masterson tonight.
Why do they do that?
I don't know. And thanks so much for our producer, Alex Lefchuk. And now...
I think... Oh.
It's time we went. It's time to go.
There's the moon is full.
Moon!
They hear.